You're listening to the CEO Series with Carl Moore on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Welcome to the CEO Series. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University. Each week, the CEO Series takes you inside the minds and lives of Canada's and indeed some of the world's top leaders to discuss strategy, leadership, and today's pressing issues. And some of the world's top leaders have spent time with us, like Justin Trudeau, Muhammad Yunus, Nobel Peace Prize winner for microcredit, and Sir Richard Branson. This show gives you a thin, well, perhaps not so thin slice, the kind of thoughtful leaders that come to our class at McGill. Today, I'm delighted to be sitting down with an old friend, Brian Featherstone Haugh, who I've known for a number of years and was a CEO, has written about CEOs, and in fact is a CEO coach and consultant. Brian, where are you from and what did your family do back in the day?
So I'm a Montrealer, born and bred. I lived about a third of my life in Montreal, a little less than a third in Toronto, and the last chunk in New York City. And grew up in Dorval and was a hockey-playing kid and learned a lot of lessons. My father was a lawyer. My mother worked in marketing and just loved my time in Montreal and loved coming back.
Where did you study and what did you study?
So I studied in McGill. I started in the accounting department, or the accounting discipline. I took my first accounting course, and then I took my first marketing course, and I fell in love with marketing. Right out of the starting blocks, I changed right in the first semester, and so I completed my BCom with a concentration in marketing, quite a bit of psychology, organizational behavior, and some stats and accounting thrown in.
Any interesting summer jobs during your time as a student?
I had the best summer job ever, which was to be at the age of, 19, the president of the student-run corporation at the time, the McGill Student Entrepreneurial Agencies. We had 125 part-time and full-time students. We sold hot dogs at the football games. We sold calculators and primitive old student technology. We sold week-long trips to the Bahamas. We had bartending courses. We had marketing research services. And my pet project was selling recycled whiskey barrels from the Shenley Distillery over the summer of my 19th year.
Who would you sell them to?
And why? We sold them mainly for gardeners, people, these beautiful, beautiful old white oak whiskey barrels that were going to the scrap heap. And we worked with a distillery. We cut them in half and spruced them up a bit. And we sold them for the princely sum of, $12 or $15. And people loved them to plant new life in these beautiful old whiskey barrels.
There's probably a few scattered around.
There's probably they last a long time, so there are a few around.
We have the Dobson Center for Entrepreneurial Studies, and it's a big hot topic. But you're saying 25 whatever years ago, It was a topic that of interest to a lot of people back then.
Yeah, I think entrepreneurship is even more relevant today. I think it was a lot of people were looking for the big corporate life, looking, as always, for the big consultancies and, the investment banks and so forth. But, entrepreneurship, as I see it, is everywhere a much more dominant and prominent career choice for a lot of people. I was teaching a class with the Ben Sadoun School of Retail Management earlier this week. I was really impressed with the entrepreneurial spirit in the classroom. Yes, they'll be working with important medium-sized and big companies, but there's a lot of entrepreneurial aspiration, ambition, and passion, and that's wonderful to see.
Is that partly because, you work for some big companies we'll get to in a few minutes, but the world needs that because the world is more rapidly changing than when you and I were young?
I think that's partly it. Also, the barriers to entry are more open. People can live anywhere. They can serve markets anywhere. Obviously, they have the tools to reach people. Some of the capital markets are more fluid. So I think some of the barriers have come down. In my day, a lot of the entrepreneurs were the daughters and sons of entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
They grew up with an entrepreneurial role model, and that's not so true. I think there's more role models and, as I say, more entrepreneurial ambition, and I think it's wonderful.
So your first job out of after you graduate, what was your first job or two?
First job was with Procter & Gamble. So very traditional, very foundational brand management. Yep. Learned about the value of brands, learned about some disciplines of marketing, really enjoyed it. I discovered, you know, 4 years in, I was a brand manager. I loved the training, but I found the diversity of the problems and sort of the intellectual diversity of the people around me was a bit too narrow. They were unbelievably smart in very much the same way. And I was hungering for something a bit different. I got exposed to advertising, creative businesses, and I moved to Ogilvy, the big advertising firm, just initially with their Toronto office, and I really fell in love. And I discovered it could be that intersection between business with some good disciplines, but the limitless possibilities and the different ways of looking at a problem that comes with real creativity. And I had a tremendous life, almost lifelong, almost career-long association with that industry and that firm. And it really clicked for me.
What brought, took you down to New York eventually?
So I was I started again with Ogilvy in Toronto, grew up through the ranks. I was president, CEO of the company. I was a pretty early guy in my 30s. And I got a knock on the door one day. Come to headquarters. Come to New York. We actually have a very big business down there, a big global client, and we were in trouble. And they needed somebody who wasn't American, because part of the trouble was we were being too American-centric with this big, big, truly, truly global client. And so despite the fact I had a great gig in Toronto, young family, you know, really good situation, the company was growing, I decided to make the leap. And I was going to try it for 2 years. And that was 20 plus years ago. And so I've been based in New York doing global roles for 20 plus years. And again, I wasn't sure it was going to work.
So you left Ogilvy a couple of years ago. Why did you leave Ogilvy and what are you up to today?
So I retired from corporate life. I'd worked with Ogilvy as the CEO of their digital marketing and consulting group. We had a big, beautiful team, about 5,500 people around the world, 50 offices. I did that for a long time. That was about 15 years. I transitioned to become the chief people officer of the whole Ogilvy group, about 20,000 people, as part of a pivot in my own career. And I retired from that heavy-duty corporate life. I frankly didn't want to do 70 hours a week of Zoom calls. I was the chief people officer during COVID. Mm. It was about closing offices, opening offices, making sure our people didn't die, who's ill, who's not ill, whose family is affected. Without the joy, being really in touch with the creative and human side. And so I had had a wonderful, wonderful long-term run. I worked with the parent company, WPP, for a couple of years, advising them on talent. And then I set off on my own, and I did a strange thing. I read my own book. My own book, which is on long-term career strategy, says, here's chapter 3, the last big chunk of a long-term career. And it says, pass the torch, light a new flame, and stay fresh. And I read it and thought, that's actually pretty good advice. So I passed the torch to the next generation of leaders at my former company. I had this emerging brewing flame around talent, talent of the future, leaders of the future. How can they tackle these unbelievable challenges and stay resilient and enduring? And I made a commitment to myself to stay fresh and not just be a corporate historian and storyteller, but take any experiences and really study. So I studied leadership. I studied resilience. I study what's really driving the future of work. And I've spent the last 3-4 years and formed my own company.
So, Brian, the challenge as you get older is passing the torch. And a certain you got to make sure you go, you don't say kids, what do they know? You got to have the humility to step away. Did you ever sense, I asked CEOs of companies, particularly startups, a good one says, every year I ask if I'm the right person for the job and I will replace myself.
Yeah.
Dax DaSilva did it at Lightspeed recently. Daniel Lamar at Cirque du Soleil, two people have come to class and stepped away, partly because of, not Dax, he's a relatively young guy. Danielle is just, I've done this for years as you have.
Yeah.
How do you make sure you feel comfortable that these people are not going to screw it up, but they're really good?
So, you know, passing the torch is an emotionally and, you know, business risky adventure. And at a certain point, you just give them the chosen people the best chance to succeed, and you need to move on. So give them everything you've got, all of your active wisdom, based on everything you know, not what did you do in the past, how could you help them in the future? So it's thinking, taking everything you do and literally projecting it forwards, not backwards. So I think that's the biggest gift that sort of torch passing, you know, senior executives can do. And then at a point, let it go. You let it go because you have a new role. You are not the shadow CEO. You're a different thing. You provide value in a different way. And often it's going from an operating role, setting goals, managing performance, counting up the chips, whipping up the team. You go to an advisory role. But you have to bring the same freshness and creativity and diligence to that role, because it's not just the past. It's how the wisdom of the past can be projected into the future.
Today, I'm delighted to be speaking with Brian Featherstone-Ha, who is a consultant and advisor to CEOs and people around the world. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CEO Series. Next up, we'll talk about how do you not become yesterday's person? How do you keep so au fait with today's world? And I think he's already touched about that, but we'll explore it a bit more.
Top-notch insight from proven leaders. This is the CEO Series with Carl Moore on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Hello again, I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CEO Series. Today I'm sitting down with Brian Featherstone-Ha from New York, a Canadian who ended many years in New York City and is down there as a consultant to CEOs and other executives.
I interviewed a guy named General Martin Dempsey, taught with him at Duke, and he was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff under Obama. He was the general when Obama went to war, if you would, he would stand beside him. He said to me, "General fight the battles of their youth. You and I learned about leadership in our 20s and our 30s and 40s. How do you sort out timeless wisdom from yesterday's truth, Brian?"
I think you have to study the future, and I mean study. So when I retired from corporate life, I got up at 7 o'clock every morning, read everything about the future of work, everything about the future of leadership, everything about pros and cons of hybrid work strategies. I would consume 10 articles a day, couple of books a week. I'd talk to people, again, not of the past, but of the future. What are they worried about? What are they thinking of? What are the trade-offs? So, and I think that is the job of every person entering that third stage, literally every day. If you're not doing something to stay fresh, you are writing your own exit ticket. People will hear a story, a piece of history once. If it's not relevant to them and the challenges ahead of them, they will only listen once.
But you've run into a lot of people that are become yesterday's person, you know, and tell stories from the past. You and I might remember Reagan or things like that. And that's charming and we love it. But there's a point where it's that looking to the future and being willingness to be taught and learn that's a central part to it. How long did you do that for? Months or weeks or how long was that?
18 months.
So a long time.
18 months. And I looked at all the new data, you know, from World Economic Forum, from McKinsey, from, you know, workplace, from all of the, you know, data sources. I tested some hypotheses against what I believed to be true from the past, discarded some, created some new hypotheses, and really created a new model, which has lots of great eternal universal wisdoms built in, and lots of things that are new and different and are of the next 3, 5, and 10 years.
What are three things that are still true today and three things that are the future truths that we've got to come to terms with in business world?
So the truth that has always been true and is more true than ever is you cannot lead alone, and you must create allies and stakeholders. And my entire coaching practice is not built on what I think, not built on what the CEO or aspiring CEO thinks. We systematically identify a behavior that would make them a better leader with input from their stakeholders. And we measure it. And sometimes I do not get paid if that CEO does not achieve in the ratings of their stakeholders. Could be junior people. Executive, you know, very high level executives asking associates to rate them on certain topics. It is tremendously effective. So number one, stakeholders, allies, I refer to career ecosystems, you know, people propelling leaders forward, absolutely no question. I would say that the ability of leaders to set intent, strategic intent, and then right down to daily intent. Today, we're going to do X. I call it big dreams and little micro goals. I think leaders have always been thus, and the best ones continue to do that. I think that big leaders, enduring leaders, invest their time really wisely. Strategically, I refer to personal time portfolios. How do you invest your time? Work, teaching, life, family, learning, spiritual, fitness, wellness, etc. And really thinking of it strategically and then taking it right down into your calendar. If that's your strategic intent, that's your asset allocation of time, what's today look like? What's tomorrow? What's the most important thing you're doing today? And so I think those are three things that leaders those are enduring truths about leadership.
So what are three new things that I may well be surprised by?
Yeah.
Well, hopefully not, because I work with undergrads, so I'm hopefully today's person. What are three newer truths that have struck you in your research and now in your consulting, your work?
I think one is the vaporization of the decision time float. And by that I mean, back in the old days, if I wanted to declare war against you, I would have a monk illuminate a declaration of war. I'd put it on a ship. 18 months later, we'd duke it out.
Yeah.
Now, today, tomorrow, you get real-time data. There's no time float. And I think that's very, very stressful on leaders. One of the reasons I'm very empathetic towards emerging leaders and rising stars. They have time challenges that are more acute than anything that we have seen before. I think hybrid work strategies and the whole dislocation of geography is tremendously challenging to leaders of today. And, you know, it wasn't because of COVID, but the pandemic definitely accelerated things. Where's your team? They're not in the Montreal office where they used to be, or in the store, or even in, you know, five knowable places. They're everywhere. And it's not that they're only everywhere. Some are live. This is the great challenge of hybrid. Some are live. Some are online. Some are always remote. Some are sometimes. This dislocation of a previous truth, Sometimes it was everybody's here in the office. That was the default for the vast majority. Or everybody's remote. But this is very, very challenging for leaders. And we all know senior leaders who are grappling with it and employees who are grappling with it every day. And they are both the employers and the employees are making big decisions on who to work for and who to hire into your company based on these decisions. That's a really huge one, dislocation of geography.
What's the second one? So, put you on the spot entirely.
So no, the first one is time float.
Yeah.
The second one is the dislocation of the of geography.
Yeah.
You can't count on it anymore. And I think the number of stresses that leaders face today are more. So these are stresses from kids, parents in a sandwich generation, addiction and issues, cyber threats, death scrolling on social media, other energy vampires. I do an exercise for all of my leadership candidates, and I just say, just check the boxes. Here are the 15 classic sources of stress. And I say, have you experienced any of these in the last 12 months? The average person checks 7. And I say to them, and I don't ask them to reveal necessarily what they are, but I say, so do you ever wonder why some days you feel burned out? Do you ever wonder why some days one of your employees missed a deadline or is really angry or disengaged in a meeting? Because they've got these too. Every single person I've ever spoken to checks off multiple. And so I think the diversity of stress triggers is the third factor.
Today, I'm delighted to be speaking with Brian Featherstone-Haugh from New York, a Canadian consultant to CEOs and other executives. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CEO Series. Next up, I'll ask Brian how we should reduce our stress.
Exclusive access to some of the most successful leaders out there. This is the CEO Series with Carl Moore on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Hello again. You're listening to the CEO Series, and today I'm speaking with Brian Featherstone-Haugh from New York, a former CEO himself and a Canadian consultant to CEOs and other executives.
Mental health has become an issue that we're more aware of.
Yes.
And it probably was more of an actual issue, but we're more aware of it, I think. So you touched on stress. So what's your advice on how do we reduce the stress in our lives but still do our job and still be a useful human being?
There's no stress-free life, certainly no stress-free career. That's called deceased. Those are the only that's the only state under
something
which we have no stresses.
Forward to. Yeah.
So there's healthy stress and there's manageable stress, and burnout is unmitigated, relentless, overwhelming stress. Yeah. That's what it is. So you need to fight back. And there are a couple of ways of fighting back. And managing your time strategically is one of the ways. Managing your allies is one of the ways. You never have to fight alone. And another one is managing your day-to-day energy. And there's a couple of techniques that I've seen very successful. One is, every day, what's my intent today? Write it in your calendar. The single most important thing today.
Okay.
That is so galvanizing, and it just keeps your eyes on the prize for each day.
Yep.
Number two, gratitude. When we wake up in the morning, what happens? We read the crappy news. Mm. We do desk scrolling on social media. We're already behind the eight ball 3 minutes into it. We read emails. We're already behind the eight ball. So this technique I learned from a doctor at the Mayo Clinic on resilience, 2 minutes of gratitude. If you normally get up at 6:30 in the morning, set your alarm for 6:27. In bed, for the first 2 minutes, pick a person, living or dead. A business colleague, a student, a mentor, whatever, anybody, family member. And for 2 minutes, just think about how grateful you are for that person, what they did for you, how they supported you, how they made you laugh, and just this act. And it can be a different person every day, all kinds of different people. It's your way of inoculating yourself against the onslaught of these stress triggers. And shockingly, it works. So every day, 2 minutes, eyes closed, in bed. And it's just a small, simple way of fighting back against the stress triggers. Become a big fan of breathing. Breathing for resilience as a leader, not as a monk or a yogi.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of techniques, one I call star breathing, the other the cooling breath. And if you have a tough conversation, you need to be your calm, alert, best self. You can use breathing and the beauty of oxygen to stir up those positive calmness, trust juices in your body. And it's surprised me, but that is part of my
study. It only takes
my
a couple minutes. Not you have to breathe for an hour, but
no,
a few
this
minutes.
Is, one of them you can do in 2 minutes,
yeah.
And the other one, star breathing, I call five-star breathing. You can draw a picture of a star as you're doing certain breathing techniques, maximum 50.
Yeah.
So between two. So this is a great little piece of the beleaguered executive's toolkit to manage their energy on a day-to-day basis. So those are a couple of examples of how to fight back.
When you think about it, you and I are corporate careers. What you were trying to do was pass on to younger people Ogilvy's culture, how we do things at Ogilvy, and set an example to teach them about leadership by just watching you in your better moments.
Yeah.
So young people say, what's Brian doing?
Yeah.
And they might on the way say, why did you say that to that person? And you go, well, it's because of this and had to do that. And so you were mentoring young people. The problem is on Zoom and Outlook, it's hard to do. Microsoft Teams, it's just hard to do that. How do we pass on culture and how do we mentor and teach leadership to the next generation unless we're in person?
So it is very challenging. I don't believe it's impossible. The vast majority of my highly sensitive, highly confidential one-to-one CEO coaching is done remotely.
Well,
I currently have no clients in New York City. Some of them I have not met live, though every opportunity I get, we'll break bread together, we'll laugh about some family moment of truth. So I think that a hybrid strategy, as long as you're using the whatever those live moments are to bond, to build emotional bonds, social bonds, make it really matter. I describe, you know, the new in-office experience should feel more like Pixar meets Burning Man. Do not go to the office to do Zoom calls and email. What a horrible squandering of precious real estate and time. And so I'm really encouraging people, if you were my boss, and you go in Tuesday, Wednesday, I'd say, hey, boss, next Tuesday, Wednesday, I'm going to be there. You're going to be there. Can we please set aside 1 hour? I need you to give me some career advice and how to solve or how to manage a very difficult conversation I'm about to have. Tuesday, 9:30 a.m. Using the moments, using your channels for the thing they're put on God's earth to do. So I think it's possible. I'm quite surprised of the ability of video, one-to-one, well-lit, quiet, and with lots of emotional content and engagement. I'm surprised, and I never would have predicted it 5 years ago. I still think it needs to be supplemented by sparkly, highly connected events in person.
One of the things I'm arguing, a new book coming out in a few months about Generation Z or Generation Y, as the new title is that I argue that they should reverse mentor us. So I'm talking to my undergraduate students about managing upward. And I go, you guys have got to reverse mentor me and younger, older people as well. What advice would you have to young people on how to reverse mentor and maybe older people how to be reverse mentored?
Yeah. So I think you're on a great topic. I think reverse mentoring, I described the critical need for more senior executive, experienced executives to stay fresh every day. Best way, talk to young people and ask them questions. ask them for suggestions, ask them for advice, share your own challenges. I'm about to go into a such and such situation. I'm terrified that I don't know this technology, this audience, this platform, or I don't know how they'll react. Get their opinions. A senior executive should actively seek it. And the, you know, the younger generation should feel comfortable. The seasoned boss might not do everything they say. They will not. But it's the act of being asked and the act of offering constructive, helpful, future-oriented suggestions. It's a fantastic dynamic for both parties.
It's interesting, but I say to undergraduates, 25% of the time you're mentoring me, they nod with pleasure and they smile. And I go, what's the flip side? And almost no undergraduate sees the flip side, but I say to them, 75% of the time I'm mentoring you, and don't forget that. And they laugh, but you know, I'm teasing a bit. But there's a sense that in our better moments, you and I have more to teach them. But I have a couple of older mentors in their 80s. It would not occur to them to ask my advice. But I've got to ask young people's advice. But I still think there's a role for you and I to mentor because of the wisdom that we've hopefully gathered the last number of decades.
Yeah. And I think, Carl, if we frame it in this active, future-oriented space, that more people will knock on our doors or ping us and say, yeah, I need your help. And if we don't, then I think the texts don't come.
Today, I'm delighted to be speaking with Brian Featherstone Haugh from New York, a former CEO himself and now a consultant to CEOs and other executives. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CEO Series. Next up, we'll ask Brian about resiliency for CEOs and for the rest of us as well.
They made it, and they're telling you how. You're listening to the CEO Series with Carl Moore on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Hello again. You're listening to the CEO Series, and today I'm speaking with Brian Featherstone Haugh from New York, a former CEO himself and a Canadian consultant to CEOs and other executives.
So your consulting now the last year or two has been to CEOs and people that are in the frame to be CEOs. That is essentially what you're up to. Or what, Brian, what are you up to these days?
So there's a couple of parts of my business. So my entire mission is around helping the next generation of leaders become highly effective and highly resilient. I want them to be great and stick around. Most people don't realize we have more years of career after our 40th birthday than before. And regardless of what the world throws at you, you need to embrace change, overcome adversity, bounce back. So this effectiveness with resilience is my mission. And that's the golden thread through everything I do. Every speaking engagement, every coaching engagement, every leadership workshop for rising stars. My not-for-profit work is with Goodwill Industries, and it's around getting people into work and helping them to succeed. So that's the golden thread. And I coach CEOs using their stakeholders to make them bigger, better, stronger, longer leaders. I do a workshop series called The Resilient Leader, which is principally for C-suite and rising star groups of, you know, 10 to 15 people. And I do some more pure consulting around what's the future of work and what are the implications for your organization.
The effectiveness, that makes sense. A senior executive has got to be effective. The newish bit in my mind is the resilience part. So you're arguing it's more important today than it was 5-10 years ago because it's a different world. What should we know about resilience and how can I become more resilient?
So we all have some, and I do an exercise which is, you know, just name a crisis or really moment of truth. And the one thing I know is somehow you're in this room or you're on this call or you're here in this room, you survived. And get in touch with our own ability in our past. And then I do a lot of work around preventive medicine, preventing burnout, letting people equip themselves with tools. And, you know, the three big ones are building allies and building your career ecosystem so you never have to fight alone. And it's your champions, your experts, your colleagues around you. They help you fight these battles. Mm. So number one, allies. Number two is investing your time wisely. It makes you a fuller, just like an investment portfolio. If you're all bonds or all stocks or all, you know, emerging markets or all commodities, that's your portfolio financially will burn out in bad situations. There will be circumstances you can't get through. Diversification, with a healthy diversification and periodically shifting your slices of time, your asset allocation. So the use of time is another one. And the third one is bringing your humanity. The best leaders, the most resilient leaders, I describe as the velvet hammers. And we've all worked with velvet hammers. They're strong, but they're warm. Mm. They make decisions, but they do it in a human way. These bosses last. The best bosses I know are strong, but warm, especially today. Great resignation, quiet quitting, highly empowered employees. If your leadership style is not something followers want to follow, you're dead. It'll get you today or it's going to get you tomorrow. And so bringing your humanity is really important. That's the warmth side. People really respond to it. And even not shying away from tough decisions. We're going to close the division. Let me tell you what this means for you. I'm backing you in a certain, any of these difficult conversations, hiring, firing, didn't get the job, didn't get the promotion, making big strategy choices that has consequences, but doing it with an appreciation for human impact, what it means. As humans, we worry about things that all we need to know is like, why'd we do this? Just thoughtfully, please tell me, why did we do this? And so these velvet hammer, strong but warm leaders, especially I think in this world, are becoming more enduring, more attractive. Mm.
When we were young, I wrote an article for The Globe a few years ago that, you know, I was told never apologize, never explain. And I wrote a piece saying really bad ideas with Generation Z. Apologize easily and explain everything. I mean, there might be occasional HR issue you can't explain, but you explain your reasoning. Because what I find is young people go, I actually disagree.
Yeah.
And they present the reasons and you go, that's a good point. I changed my mind.
Yeah.
Not everything, but there's going to be times where by explaining the why, we'll change what we're thinking.
I think your refuting of that old truth is exactly right. Here's an example from my world of running big client service businesses. Young people would come to me and say, I want to go meet the CMO. You know, I've been here for 4 months. I've never met the CMO. And I say, okay, so you're ambitious. You want to succeed. Let's agree on that. I will support you. But let me tell you something. If I took you today, let's jump in a cab, go visit the CMO of a Fortune 500 company. One of two things will happen. You will not speak. And the CMO will tap me on the shoulder at the end of the meeting and says, who is that and why am I paying for them? Or you will speak without full context and the CMO will tap me on the shoulder and say, that person doesn't know our business. Please don't bring them back again. Mm. Let me give you a third alternative. Let's work together to find a project. Maybe it's retail trends among millennials or, the shopping habits of Gen Z that they are interested in. And you go away for a month. You study this topic. You research it. You footnote it. You create a 3 to 5 minute presentation. You rehearse it 10 times. I rehearse it with you 5 times. Then we'll work to find 3 to 5 minutes at the end of a meeting with that CMO and say, I'd just like to introduce you. You haven't met Jackie yet. Remember that topic, shopping habits of millennials. Jackie, do your thing. Jackie will possibly totally rock it. so that the CMO will often say, where's Jackie been all my life and why aren't the rest of your team as smart as she is?
Yeah.
Or they'll sort of buy it, but Jackie will now be a go-to expert on a specific topic, and then she can go to the next topic, and the next topic, and the next topic, and the next topic, and build equity and confidence as a serial expert on different things, but really do the stuff, not opinions, research, footnotes, facts, rehearsal. And that to me is explaining, it's not just a no, you know, go back to your room. It's yes, but. And I think that's a better pathway.
I think that's all we have time for today. Thank you very much for joining us, Brian. I'd like to thank our scriptwriter, Stephanie Richet, our show producer, Marco Campagna, and our listeners for tuning in. À la prochaine.